Good afternoon. I want to welcome you all to the Second Court of Appeals. We're glad you're here today. We've got one case that's going to be argued today at 1:30. It's 1:30. It's the attorneys have all checked in, as I understand it, and are ready to proceed. But before we proceed, I'll ask the clerk to please call the case. I forgot to introduce the panel, so let me introduce the panel to you as well. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell, and to my left is Justice Mike Wallach, and I'm Bonnie Sutter, the Chief Justice of the Court. You may proceed.
May it please the Court. Disputes developed between our side as the appellants and the appellees over a partnership that has been known as the Moncrief Family Partnership. The latest restatement of that partnership was in 2010. A very unique feature of this partnership is that it involved Tex Moncrief, and Tex in various capacities served as the general partner in two separate capacities and as the limited partner in two separate capacities. The dispute that developed concerned the Fourth and Fifth Amendments to this partnership, which involved the successor general partners to Tex when he passed. When he passed, Dick Moncrief and Marshall Searcy took the helm of the partnership as the general partners under the Fifth Amendment, which I will go over in just a second, tried to conduct some business. They were refuted by the appellees, saying that they did not have the authority to conduct the business as general partners. So we filed an arbitration proceeding seeking to have these disputes that had arisen arbitrated. Shortly thereafter, the appellees filed a counterclaim in the existing suit in the 96th, which is on appeal, a declaratory judgment action, seeking to have that Fifth Amendment declared void because they took the position that Tex did not have the legal capacity and was unduly influenced to execute that Fifth Amendment. Now, simply stated, Your Honors, we contend that the disputes in this case that I have outlined should be arbitrated. The declaratory relief action that the appellees filed in the 96th court was an action that was inappropriate, and based on an arbitration clause within the partnership agreement that I know the court will read. It's 8.4 on pages 13 and 14 of the partnership agreement, which we believe is clear and unmistakable in its coverage. Simply stated, it says, if at any time during the existence of a partnership, any question, disagreement, difference, controversy regarding the partnership, or, very important, the meaning or interpretation of the agreement shall come into play, the matter shall be arbitrated in front of the American Arbitration Association. Now, I know this court knows that the law that the Supreme Court has set down on arbitrations is not only prolific, but it's clear. Once there is a valid and enforceable arbitration agreement or clause established that covers the dispute in question, a court must allow arbitration of the claim. Now, the presentation that I intend to make today is intended to demonstrate that both the validity and the forcibility of the agreement and the coverage or the scope have been satisfied in this case. And therefore, when Judge Gallagher, the Honorable Judge Gallagher, entered a temporary injunction against arbitration, he abused his discretion when he did that, and he necessarily denied us the opportunity to have arbitration compelled. Now, Let's look at this. Let's break it down. Is the arbitration clause valid? I don't think there's any question in the record whatsoever that it's valid.
When are we looking at its validity? Are we looking at its 2010 validity, at its Fourth Amended validity, or its Fifth Amended validity? Are you arguing that you've got two different and distinct agreements and that the Fifth did not incorporate the original 2010? Or are you arguing there are two distinct agreements, still the 2010 that's now been amended a fifth time, and those are two distinct?
I am arguing there is one clause, and there's one clause only that was in the 2000 original agreement, and the Fifth Amendment ratified and confirmed that clause when it was entered.
Well, would you not agree that Tex could not have intended to arbitrate with himself as long as he was signing and the only signatory to any of the agreements that we're talking about?
Well, that's exactly right. But you see, that position supports our position because the successor partnership language confirms that's exactly the case. Tex did not intend to arbitrate with himself. That's why the arbitration provision and the successor's language is so important. Now, beyond the validity, which they have admitted, the question becomes, is it enforceable? Now, the threshold issue that the other side attempts to raise in their briefs is they say non-signatories, which they claim Dick and Marshall as general partners are, do not have the ability to enforce the arbitration clause. That's their position. Now, all through their brief, almost every other page, they cite a case called Jody James that the Supreme Court decided in 2018. That case is not applicable. Instead, an earlier opinion, 2011, Rubiola, is applicable. And as I will demonstrate, even the Supreme Court in the Jody James case distinguished that opinion from the Rubiola opinion. So there are really three separate reasons why this non-signatory argument does not work. One, I'm going to demonstrate expressly under the partnership agreement itself, it allowed successors and assigns to step into the shoes. It bound them under the partnership agreement. So Jody James does not apply. Number two, there is a doctrine that I know this court is aware of called direct benefits estoppel, that independent from the express language of the agreement clearly is applicable in this case based on the facts. Then lastly, without stating the obvious, the management trust, which is a limited partner under the partnership agreement, no dispute, had the right independently to bring this arbitration claim. So I've got three separate independent reasons why this argument asserted by the other side as to the lack of signatures doesn't work.
Where in the order that is subject to appeal is the management trust dealt with? There's no specific mention of co-trustees. There's no mention of the management trust whatsoever in the order. With regard to injunction, is there any catch-all language that you or they are arguing covers the management trust?
I don't think there's any question it's not mentioned specifically, but the order grants an injunction against appellant's proceeding. Appellants included the management trust. And the point I'm trying to make is, independent of the claim of successor general partners that Dick and Marshall serve, the management trust had the right to bring the arbitration proceeding.
Well, I understand. But they have two representative capacities with regard to these issues. One is as the general partners under the Fifth, and one as the co-trustees under the management trust.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So my question is, to what extent are we dealing with both of those having been enjoined when we don't have any specific language as to the management trust or them in a representative capacity as co-trustees of the management trust?
Well, I take the, we take the position that there is specific language because they did file an appeal. There is no question. It's undisputed that they were the co-trustees of the management trust. They brought the arbitration claim. They brought the action in the trial court. They brought the arbitration claim, and they were enjoined. So what I'm suggesting to the court is, independent of the argument they make about non-signatories being Dick and Marshall as general partners, the management trust, independent of all of that, had the right to bring the arbitration agreement, and the judges enjoining all appellants, including the management trust, was a misapplication of the law. So let me quote to you from the Rubio opinion that we suggest controls, not the James decision. The Supreme Court in 2011 said, we conclude that signatories to an arbitration agreement may identify other parties in their agreement who may enforce the arbitration as though they signed the agreement itself. Because the arbitration agreement expressly provides that certain non-signator parties are considered parties, we conclude that such parties may compel arbitration. Those are the facts of this case. They are not the facts of Jody James. Jody James involved a complete stranger to the policy, an insurance agent who was not named.
But doesn't this case involve both sides being non-signatories?
Absolutely. So non-signatories is really a non-issue in this case, according to the language of Rubiola. It says specifically the parties can designate those successors and assigns in the agreement, which it did. When the court reads the agreement, reads the definition of partners, reads the definition of limited partners, and sees the binding language therein, that they are bound by this agreement, it will be very easy to fit that.
Doesn't that just bring us full circle back to the question of who is a successor? And they're taking the position that your folks aren't successors because the person who signed the contract didn't have capacity or was subject to undue influence.
Well, that's exactly the position they're taking, but our position is that's what the arbitration is about. That's what's supposed to be arbitrated. When you think about it a minute, Justice Wallach, that is the issue. If the court were to decide that issue, there would be nothing left to arbitrate. That is it.
What about the cases that say that mental capacity is a gateway issue to be handled by the trial court, not by the arbitrator?
It can't be under the, is our view, under the language of the arbitration clause, it can't and shouldn't be. The arbitration clause says any disputes over the meaning, interpretation of.
But that we have to get to the past the issue first of, can an arbitration agreement even provide for that? Can an arbitration agreement say that in order to be arbitrated in this case, we can just forget about the case law that says that that mental capacity is a gateway issue, and gateway issues are to be decided by the trial court?
Well, I don't think you're forgetting any case law whatsoever. I mean, mental capacity isn't defined in the arbitration agreement. It's just one issue. That's the issue that is disputed. Did Tex have the mental capacity, or was he unduly influenced to enter into the Fifth Amendment? And what I'm suggesting to the court is that under the precise language of Rubiola and the precise language of the agreement itself, that's some issue that should be arbitrated. And at the risk of repeating myself,
refresh my memory if I'm wrong, but I don't recall Rubiola saying mental capacity can be disposed of by an arbitration agreement.
Oh, no, it doesn't say that.
So that's my question is, what authority do you have that mental capacity can be taken out of the trial court's hand and given to an arbitrator?
Well, other than the authority that I'm citing, that when you extend through an assignment and binding nature to the successor partners, which is who Dick and Marshall are, that brings us right back to who decides the question. And the arbitration provision specifically and unequivocally says, in our view, that's to be decided by the arbitrators.
That's an arbitration that you are depending upon the mental capacity of Tex to be a properly you know, formed as a contract in 2010 and when he did the fourth. By incorporating it into the fifth and his and the entire contract formation, which that's why I asked the question, which arbitration provision are we talking about? Because we have to make a determination, or the trial court has to make a determination of why he didn't, whether he had the mental capacity to not amend the arbitration provision. You don't get to the arbitration provision until you find that the contract was properly formed.
Well, there's only one arbitration provision, and that was in 2010, and there is no dispute, no evidence whatsoever that Tex didn't have the capacity in 2010 to enter into that agreement. So the arbitration clause is valid. And when the Fourth and the Fifth Amendment were executed, and remember, on its face, the Fifth Amendment allows Dick and Marshall as general partners and the management trust to become the successor general partners and limited partners, on its face. And their challenge to that has to allow the successor general partners, who the arbitration clause specifically says succeeds to the general partners, they step into those shoes. It has to allow that to be arbitrated. There can't be a gateway issue, Judge Wallach, because there's nothing to gateway to.
Okay. What I'm trying to get at is there are cases starting, if we go back to the most recently the Baby Dolls case, okay, contract formation issues, according to the Supreme Court, are gateway issues to be decided by the trial court, okay? And so what we're talking about here is capacity, which is a contract formation issue. So why is that not something that under Baby Dolls goes to the trial court and not to the arbitrator?
Because the language in this arbitration clause and the underlying partnership agreement is decidedly different than Baby Dolls, and it specifically says that issue it should be decided by an arbitrator by the broad nature and scope of that clause.
Thank you.
I'm out of time, I'm sorry.
Your time is up. Thank you. Bonnie, would you add an extra minute to the appellee's time, please? I have one question before you start.
Yes,
as Mr. Kirkman pointed out, this to me is a quintessential question of which comes first, the chicken or the egg.
Yes, ma'am.
And the question is, if we agree with your position here and the trial court decides this threshold or gateway issue, what's left to arbitrate?
Well, I think one answer to that question is to look at the arbitration description or provision that the appellants filed, and I would direct the court to page 1425 of the clerk's record, which is the appellant's statement to the AAA of what the arbitration encompasses according to them. And according to them, it involves interpretation and construction of the amended and restated limited partnership agreement and an audit of the Moncrief family partnership books. So a contention that the gateway issue with respect to capacity or undue influence is the only thing that they have raised, I think the court can look at the way they've framed their arbitration demand itself. But I would like to zero in on the questions that I think Justice Birdwell and Justice Wallach were identifying, which is the question of capacity. Maybe this is another way of saying chicken and an egg. We would certainly agree with you, Justice Wallach, that capacity issues are issues for a court. And I think where the parties are not joining issue, where the appellants are not joining issue with our arguments, is the question of the arbitration agreement itself, section 4.8. We had distributed 8.4. We had distributed a handout to the court yesterday. I hope the panel has that, because the first page, slide one, asked the question, which I think is what your questions were going to, is there an agreement to arbitrate with Dick and Marshall? Because section 8.4, the family partnership agreement, does not require Gloria Moncrief, Tom Moncrief, and Gary Allen to arbitrate with the world. It says very specifically there has to be a controversy, quote, between the partners, close quote. That's the doorway to analyzing this. And so that goes to your questions. Okay, who are partners? Looking at the second bubble on our slide, Jody James says that that gateway issue is decided by a court, not by an arbitrator. The Baby Dolls case says that. Many cases say that.
Well, let me ask a question here. There's a case which neither party has cited to the court, but it's the Ridge Natural Resources LLC versus Double Eagle Royalty LP case. It's out of the El Paso Court of Appeals in 2018. It's 564 Southwest 3rd 105. And head notes 24, 25, and 26 deal with how to address this particular issue. And that is do we have a situation which deals with a true capacity issue? Is it a issue which deals with a sub-issue on capacity, and how do we deal with it? And so with the Chief's permission, I would like to request the parties give us some briefing post-argument to address this particular case to help us try to figure out how the situation fits into this particular case. And no. if y'all didn't get that citation, I'll be glad to give it again.
No, I've got it, and we'll certainly be glad to do that.
Of course, understanding it's not controlling authority on us, but it could be persuasive, too.
Understand. And I'd like to take a step back here, too, because I think part of what's going on here is that the parties are having a fight about what the fight is about. Because the appellants want this to be a fight about the denial of a motion to compel arbitration. And I think a starting point for analysis is that the trial court's temporary injunction order does not deny a motion to compel arbitration. And so talking about, you know, direct benefits estoppel and other such things, that's down the line. We're not there yet.
But it does enjoin going further on an already filed arbitration.
So why does
that not engage their issue?
Because I think under 171.023 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, and under the Myrtle decision, which we've cited and discussed extensively in our briefing, the trial court has discretion to hit the pause button long enough so it can decide the threshold gateway issue that is charged to it to decide under Jody James.
So if this is not a true gateway issue, let's just assume that's the case, does that change the ability of the trial court to issue this type of temporary injunction?
Well, certainly we contend it's a gateway issue. I think it's a different circumstance if it's not a gateway issue. But I think the correct answer to what the trial court actually did is to look at the temporary injunction itself. And if you look at paragraphs 9, 10, and 11, for example, of the temporary injunction order, it specifically says, this is a gateway issue, I have to deal with it, and if I don't temporarily pause the ongoing arbitration, then my jurisdiction as a trial court is going to be threatened, and the appellees will be irreparably harmed because, first principles, arbitration is a matter of contract.
How do you get past the argument about the management trust? Because there are no pleadings and there's no evidence that I saw from this case that had to do with the ability of the management trust to invoke the arbitration provision as opposed to the individuals.
So I will respectfully disagree, Justice Wallet.
I'm all ears. I want to hear if you can show me, direct my attention somewhere. I'm all
yes,
ears.
Yes, sir, I can, because the management trust, if you look at the flow of how this plays out. The appellants, Dick and Marshall, they assert control over the family partnership and many other things at the end of 2021 upon Tex Moncrief's death. January, they file suit, the appellants do, before any arbitration is underway. They claim authority. We file a counterclaim. But they have already filed suit in the court before the arbitration is instituted, which is a peculiarity right there. They're trying to send something to arbitration that they've already teed up in court.
But I guess my question is a bit more specific, which is, you know, there are pleadings and there is evidence with respect to testamentary or mental capacity, okay, as to the partnership.
Yes.
But I don't see that that's raised in the record with respect to the management trust. And it
is, and I'll give you specific clerk's record sites. I would direct you to volume 4 of the clerk's record, page 1720, which is the verified denial of all capacities in which Dick and Marshall purport to sue, encompassing not just a fight over the general partner status, but also their claimed status as successor trustees to the management trust.
It doesn't say that, though, does it? It's a conclusory pleading.
It is global, and it challenges all capacities. I would also direct the court to volume 3 of the clerk's record, page 1453 to 1471. That is the counterclaim. I would also direct the counterclaim that was filed by the appellees. I would also direct the court to the motion opposing their motion to compel arbitration. If you look at page 1558 of the clerk's record, you will see the denial on our part that Dick and Marshall have authority in any capacity or any way that they have tried to claim a capacity or an authority or an ability to invoke section 8.4, the arbitration provision.
Real quick question.
Yes, sir.
This kind of bugs me. You're arguing that this is a gateway issue based upon mental capacity. Okay.
Yes, sir.
And the counterclaim, if I remember correctly, brought after the death of Text.
Yes.
But the mental incapacity had to predate his death, okay, and he was a party to this proceeding. Why was there no argument ever raised in the trial court before the counterclaims that he had lost his mental capacity when he was a party to the proceeding?
In part, that's because of the way that the Fifth Amendment was sort of thrown over the transom at the very end of 2021. Essentially a couple of days before Tex Moncrief's death, and that is what set in motion the litigation, the claims and the counterclaims that were filed in January of 2022. According to the appellants, the Fifth Amendment is made, quote unquote, made as of August 10th. That's not quite saying it was executed then of August 10th of 2021, but that's what the document says. But this gets revealed to us in a surprise fashion at the very end of 2021, right upon the time of Tex's death. And then that's what triggers all the litigation and the claims and counterclaims that start beginning in January of 2022 in 96th District Court. And so I want to convey to the panel that the issues have been teed up, the issue being capacity and undue influence, and all of the capacities in which Dick and Marshall purport to act, to assert control, to be able to invoke Section 8.4 and the rest of the partnership agreement, all of those have been challenged, all of those have been teed up for this appeal. But I don't want to lose sight of the fact that I think what the trial court was presented with and what this court is presented with is a threshold question of who decides. That is all that we're at right now. So an effort to try to say that the court needs to decide whether or not Dick and Marshall can compel arbitration, we're not there yet. All we're at is the very first place, which is who decides. Under Jody James, we think it couldn't be more clear that this is a trial court decision on arbitrability. And it's interesting, if you look at the reply brief that the appellants filed at page 10, they themselves say that they're not contending that the arbitrators get to decide arbitrability. So who decides, and then if it is the trial court, as we contend it is, under Jody James and a long list of cases, then the follow-on question answered by Myrtle Consulting is, what can a trial court do in order to protect its ability to make the decision that Jody James tells it it needs to make? And that's why there's a temporary injunction to pause the prematurely already started arbitration that the appellants kicked off so it can make the decision charged to it. And so I think a lot of what the court has been presented with for decision is not really necessary for this. And I find it interesting and telling that if you look at the notice of appeal that the appellants filed, they didn't invoke appellate jurisdiction for the denial of a motion to compel arbitration. They invoked jurisdiction only for an interlocutory order granting a temporary injunction. And so I think that reinforces that all of the side issues that the court is being invited to address are really not there.
Let me ask you this. Morgan Stanley stands for the proposition that mental capacity is a contract formation issue and therefore should be decided by the court.
Yes, sir.
It does leave a little bit of a caveat with regard to whether, unless there is an expression that something that would be a contract formation, I think, would be contemplated by the contract in question. Here, the arbitration clause really isn't effective given he's the Texas signatory on everything unless he's dead or incompetent. So why should that not be something that we should take into consideration to determine that he, in effect, was saying anything having to do with his death or incompetency should be subject to arbitration?
I think the answer to your question, Justice Birdwell, goes back to the language in Section 8.4 itself, between the partners. The language of the arbitration provision is based on a controversy, not just any controversy in the world, not just any controversy having something to do with the partnership agreement, a controversy between the partners. And so it inescapably leads to the question of, are Dick and Marshall partners with the ability to invoke 8.4? And I want to, maybe I can answer your question as well by touching on what it means to have a valid or a binding arbitration agreement, because that's certainly the drum that the appellants have been beating. Valid as to whom? Binding as to whom? That is the question in this particular context when you are dealing with appellants who are strangers to the family partnership agreement, who are not signatories to it. And so validity is a shorthand phrase, but I think the appellants are using it in an imprecise and erroneous manner. Valid and binding and enforceable as to whom? That is the starting question. When you ask the right question at the start, then it gets to the correct analysis at the end, which is that is a threshold question. It's a gateway question. They aren't partners if the documents that appellants rely on are the result of incapacity or undue influence, because their contract formation, they're ineffective, void, and so it is inescapable that that is a threshold, a gateway issue, an arbitrability issue. There's a lot of different names
you
can use for it.
It's also the ultimate issue. It's like the ball game's over once that's decided, right?
Well, there may be some potential overlap. I would go back to the point, though, that the arbitration, as it's been presented by appellants, they've described what it covers. It's not, according to them, limited to that issue. The arbitrability or gateway issue may well have an impact on what happens in arbitration, but I don't think that in any way takes away from the trial court's obligation to make the gateway decision. The court is entrusted, it's obligated to make that decision, and then the effect that it has on the arbitration is the effect that it has on the arbitration. I think that that's really the kind of the roadmap that Jody James lays out for us.
Morgan Stanley, by adopting the Tenth Circuit's approach, the status versus conduct, effectively says when it's status, it deals with both the merits and the arbitrability at the same time. So I'm looking at Morgan Stanley as what we're supposed to be looking at, but noting that Morgan Stanley talks about the Tenth Circuit opinion, which says merits and arbitrability under certain circumstances, particularly mental incapacity, since it's contract formation, are determined at the same time by the trial court.
And I'm certainly not going to disagree with that statement. That's a crisp statement of what I've been attempting to
articulate. After being nice to you, I'm going to ask you the real big hand grenade one, which is, does the trial court actually have jurisdiction over this? We've been made aware through the briefing that there is a testamentary capacity issue being raised in the probate courts. In what universe does the trial court have jurisdiction to determine Texas testamentary capacity outside the context of the probate proceeding?
A hard and a fair question, Your Honor, and I think the answer is this. Capacity and undue influence cut across multiple issues in multiple courts, including the probate courts dealing with the management trust and so forth. I think that at the end of the day, there may need to be some traffic cop directing that goes on as between which courts are ultimately going to run with an issue. As the court is aware, probate court number two has been addressing issues. Probate court number one has been addressing issues. With respect to the management trust, there is the possibility of what I would colloquially call reach out and grab jurisdiction that may park everything in one place. But I guess the best answer that I have for Your Honor's question at this juncture is, whichever court is going to handle this, it's not an arbitrator's job to handle those issues. And the courts may have to sort this out itself. That may be part of a...
But if the 96 doesn't have jurisdiction, because there's some other court that has exclusive jurisdiction over that issue, then we don't have jurisdiction to hear this appeal. Well, I guess I'm raising a subject matter jurisdiction issue in the middle of our argument.
Well, I don't think that there is necessarily a dispute about, for example, trial court jurisdiction to address the Fourth Amendment versus the Fifth Amendment effectiveness. And so I don't think it would be accurate to say that the trial court is completely without jurisdiction and therefore this court can't review anything. Yes, there are many disputes, many arms and legs to this dispute, and it's complicated for that reason, but all of the things that you're highlighting, I would submit, are things that courts need to decide, handle, and can't be peeled off, because what's really going on here, just to look at the practicalities for a moment, is that Dick and Marshall tee up the issue of their control, their asserted control over the partnership and many other things in a trial court, and then they turn around and they try to shunt off the gateway issue into arbitration. And I just don't think that is a practical or an appropriate way for this to be handled. And I'm with the time that's, I see I'm about out of time, so I'll answer any other questions that the panel has.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Kirkman, before you begin, I've got a question. If we agree with your position, my question is, what relief is appropriate? Because it seems to me that the court really didn't rule on the motion to compel. I understand your argument to the contrary, but shouldn't it really be a reverse, the temporary injunction, set that aside and send it back to the trial court to determine the motion to compel arbitration?
I don't think so, because by granting the injunction against arbitration, it necessarily denied the motion
delayed
to compel.
It.
So
it delayed it, but did it deny it?
Well, I suggest respectfully that in effect he did, but if the court were to reverse and send it back to the trial court, then you would have to order that the trial court order it to arbitration, because there's no dispute there. And it goes back to your question, Judge. This is the whole ball game. If you have any question about it, Justices, read their counterclaim. The only thing that they raise is the capacity and undue influence regarding the Fifth Amendment. That's all they raise. This is a whole ball game. There's no gateway. It's like driving a big truck through an open gate. There's no opening of gate. There is no gateway issue. It's the whole ball game. As respects the management trust, Judge Wallach, there is no evidence within this record whatsoever challenging the capacity of Dick and Marshall as respects the trustee's situation in the management trust. The verified pleadings that my esteemed counsel talked about, they're not evidence. Pleadings are not evidence. And they don't rise to the level of any challenge. So I think a straight, simple path to resolution is the management trust challenged it. They didn't contest that. It's over at that point. Now, as respects what I think I finally grasped the initial question, Judge, on the capacity of challenge, capacity has to be challenged the arbitration clause. That's where the whole challenge to this gateway issue has to be. It's to the arbitration clause within the MFP agreement. And there is zero evidence the text didn't have the capacity in 2010 when that agreement was executed. Zero. That's not the issue.
But that's not the agreement that you're seeking to enforce. You're seeking to enforce the 2010 agreement as amended by the Fifth Amendment. That's a totally different animal than the 2010, because the amendment is what did Tex intend to amend and what did he intend to leave alone. That's what you're seeking to enforce, is the agreement as amended, not the 2010 agreement, because that agreement doesn't exist anymore. It's either the fourth or the fifth, and the determination of the fourth or the fifth requires a determination of mental capacity.
Well, it would be our position that the original agreement in terms of the arbitration clause did continue to exist, because all that was amended in the Fourth and Fifth Amendment was the successor general partnership aspects of Tex.
But that requires us to find that Tex intended that arbitration agreement was intended to remain the same when he amended that agreement on the Fifth Amendment. We can't discern that because that's a contract formation issue based upon his mental capacity.
May I suggest that you read the Fourth Amendment, which was done in 2019, which is the exact same language that nobody...
It's the exact same language from 2010. The agreement y'all are seeking to enforce is the agreement that was amended as the Fifth, not just the Fifth Amendment, but what it also amended as the entire integrated agreement. And it's that integrated agreement that's being sought to be enforced.
Well, the integrated agreement in terms of the Fifth Amendment by its terms. And what I'm respectfully trying to suggest is that when it ratified the original agreement, I just don't think that becomes an issue. And again,
only ratify it if he has the mental capacity to ratify it.
I agree with that, but you're kind of coming full circle back to the whole question of what is it that the arbitration provision required? And I really think you said it perfectly. When you read the arbitration clause, it can't possibly escape your scope analysis that it was intended to cover this. This is what he intended to cover by the arbitration. And if you take the whole ball game away, and if you allow the court to decide this non-starter gateway issue, you are completely taking away any effect of the arbitration clause that has been in that agreement since 2010, that is unquestionably not challenged as being invalid by the other side. You're just usurping the whole meaning of that clause, and I respectfully suggest that you shouldn't do that.
Thank you. Yeah, I was going to do that. So we look forward to receiving and considering the supplemental briefing. Is 10 days going to be sufficient for both sides to? Is 10 days sufficient for both sides to respond to that El Paso case that Justice Wallach identified?
It is.
Okay, great. And before I let you go, I wanted to tell you that I do most of my reading on the weekends, and I did not look forward to reading the record or the briefing in this case. But I will tell you that when I dug in and read, I was pleasantly surprised at how pain-free the process was. You, both sides in your briefs, made a complex situation very simple and easy to understand, and I think that's the essence of excellence in brief writing. And I commend both sides for the hard work you did in making something difficult very easy for me to understand. So I thank you for that.
I would agree with that. The original, just trying to figure out who the parties were, made my ears bleed.
But
so
you did a fantastic job, and I appreciate so much. Your case has been submitted. You're now free to go. Thank you.